I was just gonna say, you know, like when someone gets a bounty in LATs, the sound that is on the reverb, you should put that in your tool when something
Dude,
comes
I
up.
did
Maybe
that.
it'll motivate you.
I did.
Oh,
I
you
did.
did.
Hey guys, real quick, I just wanted to do a shout out to the Hacker Content team. They've been doing an awesome job with us recently, helping with the social media management side and sort of taking the load off of me so I can focus on delivering awesome content for you guys. So if you think your organization as well could benefit from some hacker-oriented social media management help, then Hacker Content is the number one place to get it. And I highly recommend them. So head over to hackercontent.com to send in an inquiry. And if you mention the podcast when you do, you'll get your first month of social media management stuff free. So yeah, check that out. All right, back to the pod. You know, I'm not even sure we should say this on the podcast, but the link that I sent you to actually get into this is the exact same link as the last one. So there's some sort of auth mechanism problem that's happening here with guests getting into the studio.
Seems to be, yeah.
That's weird, man.
Exact same
thing. We gotta figure that out. All right, well, that aside, welcome to the podcast, J-Rock. It's good to have you on here, man.
Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, of course, of course. And the it's just us this week. Joel is moving across the country, so it'll just be me and you. And the sort of impetus for this podcast is, I don't know, man. You send me cool stuff from time to time, and I appreciate that. You know, you listen to the pod and you comment on stuff and you add stuff, and you also be like, hey, I've got this situation, you know, collab on it. So I appreciate that. And the other day you sent me this really cool bug that you ended up being able to exploit relevant to some of the content we had on the pod before. And I was like, dude, you gotta talk about this on the pod. So let's do this, man. Definitely need to do an introduction to J-Rock and that sort of thing. But let's give the listener a little taste of what's to come with this meta tag plus DOM purify bug. So I'll let you give a summary of that bad boy.
Sounds good. So I was testing an app where I had found an HTML injection in many places, but the latest version of DOM purify was used. So getting XSS required me to pretty much focus on DOM purify only and get a 0 day on there. And I figured it wasn't really worth the time. So I looked at, I started looking at the OAuth flow and noticed that there was a path traversal in the redirect URI parameter. So it allowed me to redirect the code back to any page that I wanted on the web app. So I tried redirecting it to the page where I had an HTML injection, and it worked. So I was like, I can redirect the code to my HTML injection where I had the page, well, I mean, where the injection is located at. So I was thinking of ways to leak the URL so I could steal the code, right? So started off by just testing like with image tags. I mean, it worked. I could put in any image on there, except that because of the default refer policy, it would not leak the full URL to me. It would only leak the origin, so like the domain or subdomain.
So annoying.
So that did not work. Yeah, it used to work in the past, right?
Yeah.
You could just put it that way and we could leak data, but that's not the case anymore.
It makes you miss the good old days, doesn't it? Like, can you, like,
yeah.
I don't know. Nowadays, I've just become so used to that, you know, default refer policy, you know, what was it, cross-origin strict or something like that. Now where it's like, okay,
right,
that isn't even a thing, but like, man, back in the day, we had it good when we could just leak anything from the URL by just getting an HTML injection. That was sick.
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought of like trying to see if I could change the refer policy itself. So I looked at the MDN docs because I wasn't really familiar with that. I mean, I knew what it was, but I did not know like if it was possible to change it with like a header or something or by my HTML injection. And turns out that we can with a meta tag. We can set the meta tag, and I mean, we can set the refer policy through the meta tag, and we can set it to unsafe URL where it'll send the whole URL in the refer header.
DOM purify had to catch that though, right?
I thought so. Well, actually, first, I did not know if it would have worked because the meta tag was not in the head of the HTML
Right.
page, but it turns out it
It
does
does
work.
work.
It does work. But like I said, I thought Dumperify would have caught that, and it turns out that it did.
It
Except
did?
that for it
Well,
did. It actually strips it out from the DOM itself. So when I refresh the page, I can see the refer policy is set to unsafe URL, but the meta tag is nowhere to be found in the DOM. Like, Dumperify seems to do its job. But for some reason, Chrome still sets the refer policy to unsafe URL. So with all of that said, I was able to leak the OAuth code with an HTML injection using like an image tag so that I can send the URL to myself, and along with the meta tag that is gone, but still sets the refer policy to unsafe URL. So with both of these, I can leak the OAuth code and get an account takeover.
dang, dude, that is lit. And this is still like a actively, like, this can be exploited, right?
Yes, so I was discussing it with the program itself, and it turns out that, well, I mean, we found the GitHub issue on Dumperify,
Yeah.
and they said that it's like a Chrome issue. And by looking at Chrome and the Chromium bugs, we found that it's not fixed, it's still out there, so this can still be exploited,
My favorite type of issue,
which
man.
is
Let me
cool,
just
right? Yeah.
give you a little golf clap here. That's clutch. You know, a lot of times we get people coming on the pod being like, "Look at this crazy thing that I found." You know, it's fixed now, but you know, cool story. And there's lots to benefit from that. But you know, this one's actually still active, and that's the best kind. And I was kind of clicking into this. I was kind of clicking into this sort of GitHub link that you gave me before. So on DOM Purify, they're like, "Interesting. Thanks for the heads up. Seems like it's a Chrome issue." And then you, like you said, you know, you click over to the Chrome one. And I thought this was hilarious. Like, first they like this issue's kind of old from like 2020. So they like have migrated, you know, issue trackers since then. So it's like, all right, go to this issue tracker, go to this issue tracker, and then at the bottom of it says, David Von Cleve is no longer working at Google. And so this is, you know, issues up for grabs. And then that was like 2021. So it's been like 3 years. The issue has never been touched. And I feel like this is massive, dude. Like this has really massive impact because what it seems to me is like without that meta tag even being added to the DOM, maybe just that meta tag being created as like a tag object in JavaScript, that meta or that refer policy is being applied to the page, which is kind of nuts.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And
So like I've been looking at other targets where I saw that Dumperify was used, and see if I can abuse that somehow, because I'm sure it's pretty common in many places, right?
yeah, 100%. And I see, you know, I'm looking now at this issue. I just sent it to you on Discord as well. And okay, so I misread it. I was because we'll link the GitHub issue in the comment section or the description section. But you can even see up at the top it says under headers general in the DevTools console, it says on the top picture it says refer policy strict origin when cross origin, and the other on the one at the bottom after they've done the HTML injection it says no refer. So that's pretty weird, man. That this is
It
actually
is,
allowed, and it definitely this is a good trick to get us back to the good old days of like of being able to
yeah.
leak data through the refer.
Yeah, I actually had never found something like that, because it's not something that I used to look at. But I was like, really, I really wanted to steal the OAuth code, just because I've been looking at OAuth over the past couple of weeks or months. And so I focus on that HTML injection, tried to see what I could do with it, and started looking at the refer policy, and ended up with meta tag. And luckily for enough, Chrome hasn't fixed their stuff yet, so it worked.
Made it happen, man. Made it happen. All right,
Yeah.
so that's a little taste of J-Rock and J-Rock's work. But one of the cool things about you, Jasmine, is that you're not just a bug bounty hunter. You're also like a pretty like high level security guy as well, which I kind of talked about this on a podcast with Jason Haddix a while back, but like, I feel like there's multiple routes for me in the future. You know, when I'm kind of thinking about my future, I feel like I could go like the CISO route, or like the, you know, head of information security route or whatever. I could go the corporate route there. I could go the entrepreneurial route. I could go the, you know, government hacker route, or I could you know, stay doing bug bounty forever, which is probably what I'm going to do, not gonna lie. But if I were to go the you know, C-suite ish route, I would want to be like you, because you have while still being a top dog in an organization from the security perspective, you're also very, very technical and doing bug bounty on a regular basis and in the weeds, and you're also a model, I understand. Is that accurate?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't say a model, but yeah, I guess I was approached to do the cover of a front page of an IT or security or computer magazine.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Which I did. I found it really cool, so I did it. Yeah.
Not just my role model. You're a model.
A model, yeah.
That's great, dude. So we'll put the picture up on the screen, but I'm not gonna lie, man. It's pretty good. Like that is a, yeah, that's about as good as you could ever hope for them to, you know, have the results come out. So.
Yeah. Well, shout out to the Hackerman photographer. That picture was taken in Austin a couple of years ago.
No way. Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
At one of their LHEs. And I asked Hackerman if he could use that picture. So they go ahead. So I sent it over, and the result is pretty cool. I actually have a few copies here in my place.
You gotta send me one of those. I'll put it up on my wall.
Frame it.
All right, man. So I've trolled you enough. Let's swing back around to the origin story. How did you get into security in general, and how did you get into bug bounty?
So I actually don't have like a typical background as many people who do bug bounty. I started after high school a program in accounting, because I used to be good at math. But after a year, I was like, this is not for me. So I stopped and just like worked a student job for a year. And then one day on my way back home, I saw a poster where it said like, on my way back home in the metro or subway, whatever you guys call it, of a poster of a school that started a new, I guess, computer science program. And I wasn't really like into computers my whole life, like as a kid, teenager, it wasn't my thing. And then at that time, when I was 18, I was like, I know there's are plenty of jobs in that space. Let me give it a shot. And it turns out I really loved it. I did not love it, because my first course ever in that program was C. And I hated it. I barely passed. Yeah. I'm not sure why I decided with C. Like, you should have started with the basics. Like, I didn't even know back then, like, what a CPU was. And you want me to code in C.
I know, dude. That's nuts. Wow.
So, so I ended up, like, passing the course, like, making that... the project at the end where I had to create like a game, like a Tetris or a Snake game. I forgot what it was. So I did it, but barely passed. And I actually like consulted with the school, I guess directors, whatnot.
Yeah.
Cause I told them like, it's not my thing. Like, do you have any other like options? Like, oh yeah, we have like networking and security. I was like, let me try that. So in those classes, I learned all of like TCP IP, of the OSI layers and all that stuff, firewalls, VPNs, and mostly like networking, like Linux, servers, stuff like that. I did not do any programming at all in those classes. But it was something that I liked a lot, and I got really good at it. So after I was done with school, I started working as a sysadmin. So working with networking, like Cisco routers and switches, typical sysadmin work, Active Directory, PowerShell, and stuff like that. But after a couple of years, I started to get bored. So I started looking into pen testing. Because at school, we had a few classes on security.
Welcome to the dark side.
Yeah. So we had a few classes on security, but like it was really like the basics. Like, they told us what our firewall was, what a WAF was, what an IPS, IDS, antivirus, all that stuff. And I knew that I could hack as a job. I was like, just it sounds like illegal, but if it's a job, it must be legal, right?
Right.
So I looked it up a bit and saw that it was like a regular job that people had. So I started to see what I needed to do to get a job as a pen tester. So I decided to do the OSCP certification. Mm. And keep in mind, since I started school in 18, I only started getting to hacking was like 25.
Wow.
Which is like not common in the bug bounty space, because I think you started hacking when you're like in your teens.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of us have started really early, but there have been some really amazing people in the community that have, you know, done what you've done as well, or even later, and just kind of come into it and then just, you know, shoom, absorbed all the information and you know, have amazing results. So either way works out, but right. This is definitely, I think, probably not the typical route.
It is, yeah, true. Yeah. So back in 2016, I completed the OSCP. And it's funny because I actually did an interview for a cybersecurity company in Montreal. Mm. And they did not, it was like in January, February. And they didn't take me because they thought that I was like too far back. So for me to get up to date in terms of training would have caused them too much. So I was like, you know what? This is like the game changer. Like, I'm really motivated now. I want to get it done. Mm. And then in April, I finished OSCP.
Wow.
In like 2
That's
months.
Fast.
Which is, I think, pretty good, because I think the common, I think, time frame is like 3 months where people do OSCP. And a lot of times, they don't pass in the first attempt. Mm. And I did within 60 days.
You passed in the first attempt?
Yep.
Dang it, J-Rock. Yeah. You know, I failed the first attempt. I went through it. And I was 5 points shy for the first attempt, which was so sad. And I didn't make any progress the last 5 hours. It was heartbreaking. And I didn't do the lab write-up either, right? Because I was like, oh, you know, I'll pass it, right? Or whatever. But you get bonus points for doing the lab write-up. So if I had done the lab write-up, then I could have passed. But it sucks. I'm curious your thought. I mean, obviously you went that route with the certifications and stuff like that. You know, I hear two major sort of groups of people in security. Some people are like, you know, training courses, certifications, blah, 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 blah. It's not, you know, all of it's fake or whatever. But the other group is like certifications, classes, these sort of things, they really add value. And I think it largely depends on the person, you know, it largely mm-hmm. depends on like what your learning style is and whether you're able to sit down and do structured learning and that sort of thing. But I'm curious your take on your academic experience, you know, doing some cybersecurity courses, and then all versus your certification and versus self-taught, and where you're getting the most bang for your buck out of those three.
Definitely self-taught. Yeah. Yeah. So like, for example, with the OSCP, it's, as you know, like a lot of self-taught. Well, you need to do your own research. Yeah. You need to look things up, learn how things work. But now, like, I reflect back to when I did it, I realized that with the OSCP, it's like really just the basics. Mm. You learn the basics, nothing more. Especially everything that's web app related. Mm. Like you still have like remote file inclusions in OSCP. Like nowadays, you never see that, right? And it's like really like basic stuff. So like, I think for me personally, I learn better by like myself, like self-taught. And actually, like me watching a course or a class doesn't work. Mm. For like OSCP, you know, we have like videos of things. I did not watch a single one. I was better while reading the book, Googling stuff. And so same thing today. I have a hard time learning while watching someone talk. I'm just really better at learning and my reading.
Yeah, I feel like there's multiple. I feel like I read somewhere that there's like visual learners, auditory learners, and like kinesthetic learners, right? I don't remember like the actual term for it, but it's like there's some people that need to just get their hands on it, and there's some people if they read it, you know, it'll be good. There's some people if you see it and it'll be good, you know. So I guess it highly depends on the person. But I have to say, you know, especially in an industry like bug bounty or offensive security in general, where there's so much tinkering required, where you've got to sit down there and you've got to like fiddle with this and like move this part around and, you know, adjust and that sort of thing. I think the people that learn by having their hands on something really have a benefit, you know, metaphorically, of course, because you can't put your hands on it, but like, you know, like, yeah. like playing around with it and fiddling with it. I think that's a big advantage. And I think that's a trend we do see across a lot of the successful hunters is that ability to learn from having your hands on it and kind of grow from that regard.
Exactly. Yeah, definitely. And for me personally, like, as you know, in OSCP, there's not much of web in the course itself. So I actually learned all of my web app hacking with the Web Application Hacker's Handbook.
Oh, really? Nice.
I read it twice, all 900 pages twice.
It's long. Yeah. It is long.
It's long. But this is how I learned the most. I just read through it, started tinkering around and like some websites. I remember back then I was looking at Tesla, I think, on BugCrowd. This is like back in 2017. And my first year that I did Bug Bounty, well, I wouldn't say I did Bug Bounty, but like after I did OSCP, I actually got a job as a pen tester, by the way.
Nice.
So this helped me land the job. This was like in February 2017. And in that month, I also got my first ever bounty for Microsoft.
Hey, nice.
But since I was just new, I did not find another bug I did not get another bounty for the next 6 months.
Oof.
And ended up like my first year doing like 5K.
Were you hunting on a regular basis though?
Not really. I was still like in a learning phase.
Right, right.
When I was reading books, I read Peter Jaworski's book as well.
Love that book.
To get like real life example. Yeah,
Web Hacking 101.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Freaking Pete, man. Like, I love that book. And I'll tell you, dude, when I read that book, I don't know whether, I don't know, maybe I just didn't notice it at all. But I read through the whole book. I loved the book. I was like, this is the best book ever. Anyway, my wife, you know, she doesn't do any computer stuff, but she was looking at it one day and she was kind of just reading through it a little bit. And she noticed a bunch of like grammar errors and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
In the book. And she's like, Justin, how, like, what is going on with this? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, and maybe I had like some sort of beta copy or something like that. But I like to think that I was just so intrigued by the content that I just skipped over all of that, because, you know, the way he breaks down the analysis of the hacktivity reports, that's exactly what you got to do for all of the hacktivity reports when you're you're getting started. I mean, I imagine you learned from that as well.
Definitely. Yeah. I've spent a lot of time in just reading reports and hacktivity. I remember like daily looking at, like, let's say, let me look at XSS today.
Yeah.
So looked at as many XSS reports that I could see in hacktivity. And yeah, this is how I learned pretty much my skills that I have today is through just reading.
So let me ask this then. Did you do Bug Bounty before you got the pen tester job at all? Because you said the same date or the same month you got it.
Yeah. So not really. So I started Bug Bounty roughly after I got the job. So I had a colleague that did it a bit. And he was like, oh, you should try it. So I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And tried it. And my first attempt worked. Luckily,
no way. Wow.
With Microsoft, yeah. But then, like I said, the next 6 months it did not work out pretty well. But I was still learning a junior pen tester, so I was learning while pen testing. I had colleagues who helped me out, and with time, I guess I gained in
skills. That's good. Yeah, I feel like that's also a little bit like for me. Maybe that's my opinion, but my sort of journey was a little bit different than that, which was I was trying to get the job. I didn't have the OSCP, right? And I wanted them to pay for the OSCP for me, you know, to get the OSCP. So I was trying to get these jobs beforehand, and the way that my in with that was Bug Bounty. So I did some Bug Bounty beforehand, and I was like, hey, you know, I found all these bugs. I've got, you know, 1,000 rep on HackerOne, made X amount of money off of Bug Bounty. And sorry, something's floating in the screen. I just all of a sudden just grabbed the screen. And that was kind of my way in, was like, hey, I've already got all the skills. You can put me to work on a web app right away. Here's the proof. And you also did that a little bit the other way around, paying for your own OSCP, getting put into the company, and then starting to learn Bug Bounty. And then did you continue doing it while you were as a pen tester? And were you working on network pen testing at the time, or were you doing web stuff?
Mostly web stuff.
That helps.
Because I did not want to do networking stuff. I really like web app, even though I was bad at it. It's just I had a passion for it. I found it so interesting that you could get access to a file on the server through the web. I was like, how is this possible? Like, what's going on? And I think that curiosity, I think, helped me in terms of learning web app because I really wanted to know how it worked.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So yeah,
That
so yeah.
that's huge. I mean, it's the biggest service exposed in a lot of things. You know, if you just look at it
Right.
from a networking perspective, I did a lot of networking pen testing when I was at my pen testing consultancy. But you do the port scans, you figure out, okay, what services can I interact with? And 99.9% of the time, if there's a HTTP service, you know, HTTP-based service exposed, that's going to have the biggest attack surface, you know, as compared to
Exactly. Yeah.
other services. So it definitely makes sense to focus on it just from a network hacking perspective as well.
True.
Yeah.
True.
So then you worked there, you built your web hacking skills, and how did you turn into the bug bounty beast that you are nowadays?
I think I so at that job actually, we use one technology in particular. Since I was looking at it almost on a daily basis, found a few tips and tricks, applied that to the bug bounty, it worked.
Nice.
And I think in the end, just gaining experience, like I think what I learned while doing pen testing, I applied to bug bounty. What I learned doing bug bounty, applied to pen testing, and doing both at the same time, helped me a lot and to build that, I guess, reputation. Like, I think while I was pretty active back in like 2019, while still doing bug bounty as a hobby and not full time, I had made my way like in the top 40 on BugCrowd. I
Nice.
was mostly active on BugCrowd that time. But in 2019 is also the year my son was born, so my activity of doing bug bounty went way down
Yeah,
since.
things get a little
But I,
complicated.
yeah, a bit more. So back then I could pretty much do like all-nighters of hacking. I remember like going to bed at 5, waking up at 8, being in the office at 9, and being like really would have fine with that,
What?
but now,
No,
yeah,
dude,
this
you're
was
not one of
before
those
like in
people that needs
20.
to sleep 3 hours a night, are you?
I
Oh my
can
gosh.
sleep like 3, 4 hours a night and be
That's
okay, yeah.
ridiculous.
But now, like just last night, I was on something, stayed up until like 2, submitted my report. Went to bed at 2:30, wake up at 8, and like I'm tired, but I'm still like I can go through the day totally fine.
Wow.
I know it's not healthy, so like I try to sleep as much as I can still, so like I might take a nap later this afternoon. But yeah, I can do that.
Wow, dude, I'm jealous. If I don't get at least 7 hours of sleep, then I'm feeling it. So I'm like trying to get back my. I was kind of staying up late for a little while, and now I'm trying to get back to like waking up at 6. So I'm the past couple of days have been like, you know, feeling great in the morning, getting up, getting my workout in, you know, hitting the hot tub with the
Yeah.
coffee, you know, it's great.
Nice.
And then get started with the day, but then it's like, you know, at 4 or 5, I'm like, ugh. So I am jealous, I have to say. So okay, you've been doing pen testing. Now, did you ever do a stint as a full-time bug bounty hunter?
Roughly like
6
6 months
months.
where I did like bug bounty full time and also was like a consultant. It was like 4 years after my first pen tester job at the same company. So I decided to give it a stint for like 6 months. My son was roughly 6 months as well when I decided to do that. But I did not, it's not for me. I realized after those 6 months that I can't do this full time because when I wake up in the morning, I don't feel the motivation to hack. For me, it was like mostly maybe just because I was exhausted of doing that full time for like the past 4 or 5 years, where I was constantly hacking day and night because I was pen testing 40 hours a week, hacking on evenings 2 or 3 times a week, plus on weekends once in a while. So I probably did like 6 hours of hacking for the past couple of
Wow,
years.
dude.
So when I did it full time, I was like, let me just relax a bit. So I barely did any hacking
Oh
on
no.
well on those 6 months.
J-Rock, no.
So I actually built up my own recon tool in that time frame, which I don't use anymore.
That's another thing, dude. Like, I feel like I often I guess I've been doing full-time bug bounty for 4 years now. It's like, I feel like for me, programming was a bit of a escape that didn't pay good dividends for me. I mean, it did for a little while, but like oftentimes I'm like, you know, because bug bounty is so untangible, like, you know, sure, you can have gadgets and stuff like that, or like maybe you'll get a vuln here or there. But like, if you don't submit a report, you're not really feeling very accomplished, and you don't know for sure that you can go and do something, right? Like, you know, you don't know for sure that today, if I sit down at the desk, I'm going to find a bug and I'm going to make, you know, $5,000 or whatever, right? So instead, you say, oh, well, but I know for sure that I can write a script to scan these ports and put it in a database today, right? So I'm like, that's something that I know I can do. So I've got the thing I know I can do versus the thing that I'm not sure that I can actually do. And it becomes very attractive to do the thing that you know you can succeed in and feel like you made progress in, right? But it kind of takes you away from the thing that's actually generating revenue a lot of the time. Is that, did you generate, or did you experience something similar?
Yeah, and I think others have mentioned in the pod as well, where the cost of maintaining the tool itself was greater than the investment that you were putting in. So like for me, yes, I was able to like get a database of everything that I wanted, but I will still not first on some low hanging fruit recon related bugs, because there are people out there who have like crazy automation. Yeah. I did not. I only wanted like half data. For example, let's say there's a 0 day on I don't know, Confluence. If I know I have pages where I can find Confluence on my database, I can maybe go to it and I report it if they accept all days. But I found that I was not always first, and for the times that I was, it wasn't really worth it, worth my time looking into it. So I decided to just like do what I love, and which is just using Burp, Repeater, and manual hacking.
Yeah, man.
And if I do need recon, well, there's Today's New, Nagli, plenty of people who have data that I need, so I can just collaborate with those guys.
Exactly. And it's pretty low cost too, you know, like I mean, depending on the amount of involvement from the person, I've done splits of 25% to, you know, 50%, and it's like, okay, well, you know, if you're providing the POC, they're providing the data, you know, it's like a match made in heaven there. So it's good. Right. It's good that we have friends like that will, you know, it's kind of like Vuln as a service there, right? You know,
I was just thinking about that. Yeah, exactly.
It's good because, like you said, there's cost. You know, there's cost to just running the infrastructure itself. You know, just, you know, whatever, $100 a month or $200 a month or whatever. But then there's also like the opportunity cost of how much time have I spent coding this tool versus how much money I could have made, you know, hacking. And especially when you're good enough to do bug bounty on a regular basis, and you know, that cost is pretty high. And thinking about it in terms of opportunity cost is pretty tricky. The flip side of that for me as a full-time hunter is it's very hard for me to take time off, because I don't have any, you know, I'm not taking paid time off, right? I'm taking unpaid time off by nature of the, you know, the career path. And so it's like, it would be nice to have that automation running and, you know, hear a ding from time to time being like, ooh, vuln,
something came up, you know,
that sort of thing. I do miss that from my recon experience.
You should, I mean, do you still have a recon tool or you don't anymore?
I mean, it's, you know, like you say, it's there. It's written in Python 2.7, you know, but it doesn't, it's not running anymore actively. So Nagli is my recon tool now.
I was just going to say, you know, like when someone gets a bounty in LHGs, the sound that is on the reverb, you should put that in your tool when something comes up.
Did
maybe it'll motivate you.
I did. So I Pavlovian dogged my myself and my father-in-law too, because like you know, anytime I hear it, I'm like, you know, the heart rate would go up, the Slack ping or whatever. And my father-in-law also, I told him, you know, hey, you know, whenever this sound happens or whatever, it's a vuln that I found, because this is when I was really hitting the Route 53 takeovers, and it was like, you know, they're drop in every day, every other day. And so anyway, we'd be hanging out with them and we'd hear it go off, and he would be like, woo! you know, he needs to get up and start doing a dance. It's like, nice. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
So it's pretty fun. You know, there's definitely fun sides of the recon stuff, but I don't know. I think for me, sitting down, actually dropping some crits every once in a while from good old sitting down and doing research is really big. And then also, like you just shared right here on the pod, you find cool stuff, revolutionary techniques and innovative techniques that you can share with other people and you can keep to yourself and utilize when you're actually in the weeds doing the research rather than just trying to be the first one to find a well-established technique.
Yeah. And for me, since it's only like as a hobby, bug bounty, I don't need the money. Mm-hmm. So I don't need to find bugs. I do what I want to do. And for me, I have more fun doing manual hacking than focus on recon only.
Yeah. I believe that, man. Yeah. That's one of the things that I've been we're going deep here, but lately I'm a full-time bug bounty hunter and I do the podcast, so I've got like one standing meeting a week or whatever, right? Of like, you know, record the podcast with Joel on this time or record the podcast with J-Rack at this time. But you know, for some reason I still have that, like, and I could take the rest of the week off, no one would be the wiser, right? But I still feel that like anxiety of some sort of like, why am I not working right now, you know? Or like, even when I am working, it's like, I don't know, should I be working more? It just doesn't feel as free as I actually am. And I know in my head, I'm free. Like I could go do whatever I wanted. I could go, you know, get lunch or whatever. So I think lately what I've been trying to do is, I mentioned, you know, I talk about my hot tub time fairly often here on the pod, but you know, it's kind of like a meditation and prayer time as well. You know, go out there, enjoy the nature, pray, meditate, that sort of thing. But I've been trying to reflect on that freedom in the mornings and be like, sort of, you know, gaslight myself into feeling that freedom that's actually there, but you know, is not as easy to feel sometimes. So, I definitely understand the draw of traditional employment though. Which brings us back to what you're doing now, right? You left that full-time bug bounty and you went back into the workforce. And where did you land?
I landed in a small company in Montreal, I guess in the startup phase. The company had been founded like in 2009, so for roughly 10 years.
10-year startup?
Yeah. So they hired me to be the head of IT and security.
Okay, and so that was I reported the first jump to
the CTO. Yeah. Nice. They looked at my resume. They saw that I was pentesting for a couple of years. Back then, my bug bounty resume was building up as well. I wasn't a model yet, but you know, my name was like you. Like our names can be Googled, and they see what we do and stuff like that. So, and the interview that went really well. And then so I got hired. So I worked with everything from AppSec to compliance, like all of the topics in security, physical security as well, for that startup.
Wow, physical security as well.
For the office, and then a year later, we got acquired by NASDAQ, which is where I work now.
Nice.
So joined NASDAQ to an acquisition, and I currently work at NASDAQ in InfoSec as a senior director.
Very cool, man. I'm wondering about that transition, because if I, you know, I can say with a high degree of confidence that I understand a lot about the offensive security side of security stuff. I understand how to get in. I've done network pen testing. I've done AppSec stuff. I've done mobile stuff. I've done IoT stuff. I haven't done as much hardware stuff, but you know, here and there with Joel and stuff like that. So I have a diverse background there, but I feel like going into like a head of IT security, or in your case, sort of head of security, you know, even doing some you know, physical stuff at the office, I feel like that would put me out of my comfort zone, which wouldn't be bad, and I feel like I could figure it out. But like, how is that transition?
But you just said the word. It was definitely out of my comfort zone. But I'm a type of guy where I like challenges, and as soon as they reached out to me, I was like, man, I want this job.
Oh, that's cool.
It's like, it's out of comfort zone. I know there's like great potential, and I think this can lead to something really cool, which in the end it did through the acquisition. But so like their main goal was to get a SOC 2 report. And I had heard of SOC 2 in the past since
it's intense.
as a consultant. I worked with it a bit, but like I never led like a company getting to a SOC 2 report. So learned a lot on the job. Had to do a lot of research on what is SOC 2, what is ISO 27001, and what is all that stuff. I already knew what PCI and stuff like that, but we don't use it. But getting an idea of what those frameworks are and what they require. Same thing for like standards like NIST, all of those, I guess, acronyms that are important in the compliance right. world. What are they? What do they require? Stuff like that. So learned a lot on that and for the compliance side of things. Also, I guess, created our AppSec, our development management program. I had already had experience in doing that as a pen tester, where I kind of helped out in terms of like code reviews, using SAS, NAS, and stuff like that. So pretty much started the security program from scratch. This also includes like security awareness training program, making sure that, and also another part of my job was managing IT. So I managed Yeah. I was also the head of IT.
Oh so my gosh,
I had like both umbrellas under me. Yeah.
Definitely in a startup then. He's like, all right, you take care of all those computer things.
So I was alone for a couple of months, and I was the first employee in IT and security.
No way.
So I had to build things up from scratch. The only thing that they had. This company that did like or still do ESG. I'm not sure if you ever heard of ESG,
is, no.
Like environmental social governance. It's like hard to explain, but it's like something that is not pretty common, but it's getting pretty common out there nowadays. So we did an ESG SaaS tool. Considering it's SaaS, we do. Well, I mean, we hosted on the cloud, and so I had to make sure that our cloud was secure. So, so when I joined, the only security, I guess, tool or topic that I had covered was passwords. They had a password manager for the company. That's it. So I made sure that all endpoints had antiviruses and literally build up from scratch, like 2FA, like just get the basics covered.
I mean, in their defense, That's I mean, at least they're using a password manager. I mean, that will stop some stuff, you know. So if you had to pick one thing, you know, that might be it, which is pretty cool. I did just Google this ESG thing. I have heard of this. This is environmental, social, and corporate governance. It says is a set of considerations, including environmental issues, social issues, and corporate governance that can be considered in investing.
Exactly.
Gotcha. So you guys were building a SaaS tool for that.
So exactly a year after I joined, we got acquired by NASDAQ.
Wow, dude, which
makes sense
because
NASDAQ is in that space.
That is awesome timing. And and you got in at a pretty good level too, running all of the IT stuff for them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's what deserved my senior director role at NASDAQ, because without me at that startup, we wouldn't have gotten acquired by NASDAQ.
Wow.
So
that's sick, dude.
Yeah, I think it's
congratulations. You know. That is one boss Thanks. Move right there, I have to say.
It's quite the jump, and I learned a lot while in that year. But I'm pretty confident that I did a good job, because I think without, like I said, we got acquired by NASDAQ. So I think I did a good job.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a big dub, man. So that's where you are now, senior director at NASDAQ, doing similar things as you were doing at the startup, you know, managing a large security program or?
Not really. Mm-hmm. So since in the end at the startup, we were only two employees in security, myself as the head, and I got an employee as well. NASDAQ is obviously a lot bigger, right? So we have several different teams in InfoSec. And then I work mostly, well, not mostly, I still work in lots of different areas because I'm a senior director, so I need to look at certain stuff. So I do work with like the sales team once in a while, marketing, AppSec, compliance still. Need to talk to our SOC team once in a while in case something happens, threat intel, like a bit of everything, but mostly on like on a manager type of task. So I won't do any pen testing. Sometimes I do jump in because I want to do it. I see something, so I'll take a look. So I do it just for fun. Same thing for like red team. We also do red teaming. Yeah, so a bit of everything.
You gotta flex on the team a little bit too every once in a while. Yeah. I had a you know, when I was working at this consultancy, you know, my boss was not in the requests, you know, at all, pretty much. And then sometimes we'd have like, you know, somebody was on PTO and like we needed to double down on something, and he would like just jump in and like pop something, and I'm like, dude, this is lit, you know?
Yeah, that's cool.
And so I think also, you know, from time to time we show the people that you're working with on a regular basis that even though you're not, you know, maybe in the request every single day as a part of your job, that you can still get in there and do stuff. I think that does a lot for respect as well.
Yeah, and also since I'm seen as a manager, mm-hmm. some people don't know my background. Right. So I've had someone telling me what a cookie is. Like, dude, I know what a cookie is. Like, look me up a bit. Just but like, yeah, I've seen people like trying to think that I'm not technical.
Right.
And then I have to explain them like, oh, by the way, I know what this is. Like,
yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. So just again, yeah, get an idea of like, I don't know, like, how can I say this? Get an idea of like difference between manager type position, technical. Mm-hmm. Some people think managers are only managers and don't have technical background, but I think having both definitely help in terms of both managing and doing technical work and understanding certain risks associated to.
It's a big differentiator, issues. I think, for you as well.
Right.
You know, it gives you a lot of job security. I know even in the you know, outside of management in the sales aspect as well, you know, people that actually understand the technology that they're working with on a regular basis mm-hmm. can do sales well. You know, if you have that additional, excuse me, if you have that additional little skill set, because it's like, you know, you're actually able to talk to the points that people are caring about when they're thinking about buying a product. So, it's great being technical, man. I love being technical, because it applies to so many realms. Hey guys, real quick, I want to remind you about the Critical Thinking Discord community. There's been a ton of great activity on the chats lately. People just kind of shooting the breeze to drop in new hacking tips and advice, sharing cool research, that sort of thing. So it's definitely something you're going to want to get in on if you haven't already. Also, we've got the subscriber tiers in place now, which will give you access to really cool things like masterclass, AMA, just random scripts that I drop. It's kind of like our inner circle. So if you want to get in on that, please do. We would really appreciate it. Also, it helps support the show. So if you're interested in any of that, head over to ctbb.show/discord to join the community today, and we'll see you over there. All right, back to the show. All right. So that's the career path. Once again, I'm going to just, you know, that move that you made from full-time bug bounty to head of IT, kind of nuts. So that it's great to see your friends take dubs like that, and thanks for giving me the whole. I've heard that story in little bits and pieces, obviously seeing your face on a cover of a magazine or whatever, but hadn't had the full story. So speaking of your technical capabilities, let's go back into some of that stuff and talk about some of the cool bugs that you found and topics that that you had. So the one that came to mind that was on my list and your list was about, this is about a year ago now, you tweeted out, "It took 5 years, but I finally found my very first critical OAuth-related bug last night. I found a bunch in the past in pentest engagements, but never on a bug bounty program." Mm-hmm. And so I was like, oh, well, you know, he did the OAuth thing. That's great. OAuth is a commonly abused technology, I'd say. And it showed up in your list here as you've been finding a lot of OAuth related bugs. So can you talk about a little bit about how you developed that methodology and maybe talk about some of the quirks of the bugs you found?
Yeah, sure. So I, back in the days when I started doing web OT, I was mostly like a server side kind of guy, and still am. I focus mostly on server side bugs. But with time, I think I gained an appreciation for what OAuth is and how complicated it is, and how, I wouldn't say easy we can find bugs, but like there are so many different attack vectors in it that a lot of times you'll find something no matter what. Mm-hmm. And it only takes like one extra little piece that you can chain with it for example, that HTML injection with the DOM verify with meta tag. Since with that price traversal, I only needed one more thing and to leak the URL and sold token. And a lot of times, like, it's, I wouldn't say easy, but I've been finding a lot. So I find that, like, people are maybe not looking at it, or because I'm not finding like really crazy thing apart from one, which I actually put it in the list, which was like, what the is going on here? It's like just basic stuff like redirect UI, open redirect, sometimes it allows subdomains. So an XSS on a subdomain works as well. I could steal that OAuth code that way. Yeah, just like basic OAuth vulnerabilities. Nothing like, no, like crazy technique, just regular stuff.
You have here in the little notes that we created, mentioning Franz's Dirty Dancing blog post on OAuth. Yeah. And I love that blog post so much. We talk about it on a regular basis here on the pod because it's like he gave a name to something that was kind of, I guess, unnamed before, this whole concept of like a not happy path where the code is not parsed, right? Because the normal flow for OAuth is, you go through the flow or whatever, the code gets redirected back to the callback, and then that code gets consumed and either traded for an auth token, or that token gets used directly with the API. But if you can find some way to manipulate that callback location, then that code doesn't get consumed. And then you can use something like a XSS in a subdomain, like you mentioned, to leak that code to the attacker, and then the attacker can provide that do that swap and get the token, or use the token itself for API calls. So my pulse starts to go up a little bit anytime I see a OAuth flow where I can control any part of the redirect flow, essentially, where it's not just totally static.
And I put Franz Dirty Dancing article in there because it is what helped me really, I guess, I wouldn't say master, but I guess understand better OAuth. Because I knew what it was. I knew how we could find vulnerabilities with it, but I did not know like certain things that he mentions in that blog post that I now understand.
Yeah.
And for me, like every time I look at OAuth, I just open the tab just in case I need to go back to it. And I don't get ideas on certain things that I maybe haven't looked at. Shout out to him. Like, this is a really excellent and blog post. And not shout out, but like thanks as well, because it has led to a couple of bugs of mine just by reading his blog
post. Absolutely, man. Yeah, Franz is always coming up with crazy stuff like this. And you also have here, reading the RFC. That is one of the things that I actually haven't done for OAuth yet. I need to go down and check it out. Do you know how chunky it is?
There is like the OAuth RFC, but there's also one that's like the security best practices.
Oh, really?
Which is where I looked at the most, because it says like, it shows like all attack vectors on OAuth. Well, not all, but I guess most that they have thought of. So I've looked at that quite a bit.
Is it this one? Hold on, I'm going to send it to you in the chat. Is it RFC 6819? It's OAuth 2 threat model and security considerations.
Let me look at the. Nope, I don't think it is.
Okay, I'm gonna link this. I'll look at this one as well. Because I wish more. I suppose we should probably just read the whole thing anyway, because it's like, I'm sure there are security considerations that a lot of the RFC writers hadn't really written. Look at that. OAuth 2 security best practices.
Yeah, this is what I read.
Very nice, dude. So this is not a specific RFC. This is a...
No, you're right.
It's a draft associated with it. That's cool.
True. Yeah.
That's really good. I'm going to go ahead and link this down in the description. I've never seen this before. I'm going to go ahead and read this afterwards. This seems like there would be some great takeaways in here.
Yeah, definitely. So it shows like the best practices. But us as attackers, we can see if those are applied or not. So definitely helps in terms of finding bugs.
I'm pulling a Joel here and I'm getting nerd sniped in the middle of a podcast. I'm like starting to read this. I was like, wow, I actually haven't seen a lot of the attacks that are kind of mentioned in here. Very cool.
I agree. And I'm not sure if actually, recently I found the bug, which I put in the dog, but not sure if I can just talk about it now because it's not mentioned. So I found a weird race condition bug recently. So you know the OAuth flow, once you're logged in, I mean, you're logged in, but after a while you need to refresh the token. So I accidentally noticed that I could send the call that refreshed the token, I could send it without the refresh token and just the client ID and still get access to an access token.
That's weird. So just this, using the cookies associated with it?
No cookies. No authentication at all. Yeah, but it only worked while a user was getting logged in. So what I did was just send requests constantly to the endpoint without authentication, without a refresh token to get an access token. And when the user logs in, eventually it spits out an access token that I can use. Until this next token expires. Yep. Any user.
What the heck, dude? That is the weirdest thing ever. What is the server side?
What
does the server side code for that even look like?
They explained it to me. I would have to read it through.
That's nuts.
But this, yeah.
I've never seen anything. And dude, it's a miracle that no one has logged into somebody else's account on accident because of that. Because you'd think that there would be some sort of like collision or something.
I thought about that as well. So when I was testing it, I was just like testing the OAuth flow. And then I went in the repeater, took a request, send it over, playing with it, removed the refresh token, and it worked. Why is this working? I don't have any cookies. There's no refresh token. Why am I getting an access token?
You must have been what am I missing?
Yeah. But then the issue is how to reproduce. Yeah. So after a while, after a minute or two, it stopped working. I was like, okay, this is weird. So I thought maybe it's during the login. So I sent request an intruder, logged in and see if intruder, I got an access token. And indeed I did get an access token.
No way. I could see you just sitting there how did this, you've got the tab, the repeater tab open in Burp or the history, and you can see it giving with no cookies, with no IDs, with nothing on the left-hand side.
Right.
And then somehow it's giving you the access token. You're like, what the frick?
It's funny because I actually messaged Sebastian and Ramsexy. Yeah. I was like, guys, what do you think is going on here? And I explained, it was like, I don't know, a race condition? And it turns out it is a race condition. But I was like, I'm not sure if it's a race condition. We're not racing against anything. It's just ends up getting an access token somehow.
Yeah, it's just yeeting off the tokens out there like no one's business. That's crazy, man. Wow. And is this on a bug bounty program or is this on a pen test?
Bug bounty program. No way. I actually got paid out yesterday. Yeah, we fixed yesterday as well, so I'm happy they fixed yesterday. We can talk about it today.
That's nuts, man! I cannot believe that actually happens in a bug bounty environment. Because, on pen tests, you see all sorts of weird stuff, and it's weird is normal on pen tests because it's like, okay, all these sketchy little apps, true. But in bug bounty, I like to think that people try to do some due diligence right before they actually. Start a bug bounty program and essentially bet money on their security. So the fact that showed up in a bug bounty environment is just nuts to me.
Yeah,
very cool though.
It's crazy. Really lucky as well.
Indeed.
What are the chances of me just trying that, removing the refresh token, and by default there were no authentication cookies. It only relied on the refresh token to get a new access token.
So weird. Yeah. That's one of the things too, man, is so much of our job. That's one of the things that I think is a little bit unsettling for me as well. It's so much of our job is luck of sorts, just sort of manufacturing your own luck of sorts, just trying everything and trying weird stuff and then noticing when something weird happens.
I've had a really, I've been lucky of getting luck, if I want to say it that way. So back in an LHE in LA a couple of years ago, I'm not sure if you can say the target or not, but I won't say it just in case. There was an application that many people tested. I went through it, fuzzed a bit. So it had a weird authentication form, login form, and it just felt like I could probably bypass that somehow, but I did not bypass it, so I moved on. A day later, I start getting emails from like an internal distribution list, and those emails had like PII. So with my fuzzing, somehow I got added in the DL and was getting like access requests to data. So those emails had like employee full name, phone number, address.
What?
And they were requesting access. It was like a access request form. So they're requesting access to certain data. And I was a recipient of those access requests.
I wonder if did you submit an access request form and they're like CC all access request? No.
No, because in the email itself, we could see everybody who got the email, and it was all like the company email and me, my JRock at wearehacker1.com email in that list. So I had no idea what happened. So yeah, this is one issue I was really lucky.
Wow, man.
Another funny story is I was hacking on a big company a while back. They do many LHEs. And I found a few bugs on the app, but I was kind of stuck. And so I just sent a few XSS payloads and a blind XSS payloads and hoped that one day would pop. A year later, it pops.
What?
And then around the same time, one guy messages me on Twitter and like gives me shit like, oh, you just ruined my day. But I was like, what the hell's going on?
Oh my gosh, what?
Yeah. So obviously, I looked at my XSS Hunter dashboard first, because me, I cared more about that than the Twitter.
Right, right.
But I was just coming back from work. It was on a Friday evening.
Of course.
I had my laptop. Yeah. So I was at the mall and my girlfriend was like, hey, babe, one sec. I'm just going to sit down at the desk here and pull up my laptop and see what's going on. So I looked it up, and from what I had understood is that guy who DM'd me on Twitter to give me shit, he created a report and complaint on my behavior of putting blind access payloads.
Oh my gosh.
And that complaint got sent to an email system, an internal email system, and it popped on there.
Dude, no
so
way.
So without his complaint of my access payload, I would not have gotten that, I think, 9K bounty that I got for the blind access.
That's clutch. You should message him back on Twitter being like, hey man, I just wanted to let you made my day. Like,
oh, I did. I was like, oh, sorry, well, I'm doing like ethical testing. Like, here's a program page. It's public. Yeah. Like, we're allowed to hack. So sorry that it ruined your day for whatever you're doing. Yeah. But like, what I did is completely fine as per the policy here. And I was like, oh, sorry. I didn't know you guys were doing
and
that.
And also, so, you just made me 10 grand. So thanks.
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
I don't think it was that much, but it was like a large 4K.
That's great, man. Wow. That's a good one. I have this on the list too, because I went and watched, as I do, you know, before these episodes, I went and stalked you a little bit and watched some of your talks you've given at HacktivityCon and some write-ups you've done in other places. And it seems like you skirt the line a little bit
when it
comes to social engineering and bug bounty. Like I saw a write up, I think, of like you saying like, I submitted a contact form with a link in it, and then some admin clicked that link, and then that like one shot RCE'd a Jenkins instance in the back end or something like that. And so I'm wondering. Yeah. So one, you said you used to. So I'm wondering if you still do that. And then the other one is, how has that been received in, you know, if you had to give a number to your hit rate on those, like how many times are they like, no, that's social engineering, bad, you know, hand slap, versus like, oh my gosh, you just shelled my CI, so I'm going to give you a bounty.
It worked once or twice. This is one case where it did work through a contact form, but I don't usually do those anymore because, I mean, it never pops.
Yeah.
But one thing that I do find that it did work, again, back in the day before the referrer policy we were talking in the beginning, is that sometimes like when you test for SSRF, you put in your URL, it can be a webhook or whatnot, and sometimes it does get like hyperlinked, and you can have admins click on it, and when they click on it, the referrer used to be sent to your server. And I was able to disclose a few, I guess, sensitive data with that. Just being like an admin path that I had not seen, certain UUID or whatnot. And this still works. I had the case that happened like this week, where someone clicked on my, an employee clicked on my link, and with the same program actually that the meta tag thing. So with the unsafe URL that I had set with the HTML injection, it set it to multiple pages. So when an employee clicked on my link, it sent the URF header to my server. So I was able to leak data with
No
that.
way. That's clutch.
But yeah, it's most of the times that it did work was through like a URF header leak,
That,
where it leaked something
yeah. I
sensitive
wonder,
internally.
I wonder how many of these applications are using DOM Purify under the hood. And I wonder if we should just start sort of spamming meta tag, refer unsafe URL plus, some sort of image, tag around to try to harvest these, because image tags are going to get through DOM Purify. And then it'll send a request out, and then you'll get the referrer, and then you can kind of, maybe if there's like a security by obscurity or something like, or even just knowing in internal paths can be really helpful. Or you might get lucky and there's an auth token in the URL. So
Yeah, maybe true.
crazy, man.
Never
I like
know.
that. Do you do any other, I guess, on the fringe of social engineering stuff? Like some people will do like typo squatting or something like that to trigger, their payloads or anything.
Not really. I did buy a few domains in the past, but it was for a bug. For example, a bad regex or
Ah,
regex,
yeah.
not sure. Never knew what it is, but like
Yeah.
you found that in the past. For example, you actually mentioned it in an entry, I think, like github.com. You could do like a github.com, and so I bought some domains for that to chain with other bugs. But it's not like social
Sure,
engineering, right?
sure.
But like if you're talking about social engineering specifically, the only things that I've done is what you just said in regards to sending a link to like to a contact form, where I knew I was confident that if they clicked on it was going to work because I had recon and I knew that it was reachable through other means and whatnot. So
I feel like that's acceptable personally. I don't know. Some programs might get a little bit pissy about you submitting a something through the contact form, but I feel like that's fair play.
Just one last thing about that. It actually happened in a life hacking event, and they had an SSR sheriff. So in there, I obviously put my name to identify myself, and it got a hit. Turns out it's actually an employee who clicked on my link, so it looked like I hit it, but I did not.
Oh,
So
how did they
so
take
they
that?
did the investigation. They found out that it was an employee who clicked on my link. So it wasn't SSRF. So just
They
informative.
didn't. Yeah, but it does show that's, like how easy it is to get an SSRF of sorts, within an organization when you just send a link to an employee, they click the link, and that's, depending on if they've got a privileged position in the network, that's an SSRF of sorts. It's tricky, man. I'm sure you as a head of security guy, being a senior director of security, kind of have to think about these things as well. But like bug bounty is great for anything that doesn't affect like social engineering and stuff like that. But man, it's so much easier to get in via social engineering than it is to get in
Oh
via
yeah, for
these
sure.
application bugs.
For sure.
So,
Just last year or 2 years ago, the Vegas event. Remember what
yeah, I
happened there?
do. Yeah, I freaking
Yeah,
do,
this
man.
is crazy.
It's nuts, man. So, yeah, I think there should be absolutely, and this is, my naive opinion, but I think there should be a lot of resources allocated to preventing that sort of thing in an organization,
For sure.
because that seems to be the easiest way to make something happen.
Definitely, yeah.
Looking at the list we've got here again, it seems like you also are an advocate of getting intimate with the application, which is good.
Yeah, for sure.
And you said that there might be some stories relating here with regards to this leading to a Moab, which I assume is a reference to the episode with mayonnaise, the mother of all
Yep,
bugs. Tell me a
exactly.
little bit about that.
Yeah. So it's not like a mother of all bugs, but like I found many issues because of that. So I was getting intimate with the app, reading the docs, and
I love it. I love it so much, dude. The way I was, getting intimate with the app. Yeah, I'm sorry, continue.
So yeah, I was reading the docs and found that it did like XML parsing. It literally said like, oh, we do XML parsing, blah, blah,
Love that.
blah. But yeah, and I also realized that in some cases, the docs don't necessarily mention that it parses XML. It'll just say like the acronym, for example, I don't know, let's say XXXML. So there's a market language. A lot of times it is XML. And I had found an XSC already by reading through docs where it said like literally said XML parsing. But in those other lesser known XML formats, standards or specs, it did not say XML at all. It only said like refer to the spec on W3, blah, blah, blah. So in the docs, I looked for W3. I found plenty of them. And most of them were vulnerable to XSC. Because by default, they did not do like, they don't protect against XSC properly. So just by like analyzing the docs, seeing how they write it up, they don't always say XML, but they'll say like, we parse these kind of files, to refer to the doc on W3. So I looked at for W3, and like I said, found plenty of them, and they all led to more bugs.
That's definitely an underestimated, I think, trick when you're dealing with applications, because like I often see so many bugs in parsing of custom file formats. You know, it could be server-side bugs, could be client-side bugs. Just the other day, a friend of mine found a bug. I think we'll probably write this up and put it up somewhere, but he had to download this software and like this proprietary software, and we were trying to do it without downloading the proprietary software, but this each one of these files, because it's a proprietary software, is signed by a, you know, RSA key, you know, and it's like you can't fiddle with it at all, because we were just gonna, you know, kind of reverse the binary format and just elongate a specific field to put our payload in there. But it was signed, so we actually had to like boot up the software and like inject the payload, the XSS payload, in this, you know, piece of code, and or in that like field in the software, and then export the file, and then give that file to like a JS you know, file that was actually doing the signature validation in the browser, which is nuts, and then it would actually pop the XSS, and so like these custom formats, whether they're XML, whether they're, you know, some binary level format, that sort of thing, there's almost always bugs there. And so to your point about reading the docs though, I'll never forget the first live hacking event I went to. There was 20 minutes left in the live hacking event. This is actually Inti. Inti was talking with some people and comparing notes, and somebody was really close to finding a bug. Or to passing another person, and all they need to do is find one bug. So like, man, how can I find a bug in the last couple minutes of this event? And so he's like, you know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna go to the docs and I'm gonna control F for URL. Is what he did. And he went to the API docs, control F for URL, found an API request that was taking in a URL as a parameter, you know, and just sent that request off, and his boom, full read SSRF. It dropped in the last 20 minutes of the live hacking event. He probably got it in
Wow,
under
that's
5 minutes
crazy.
at the end. And so reading those docs and searching for things like W3 or, you know, XML or URL or that sort of thing, yeah, man, that always pays dividends.
Yeah, it does. Taking time to read it, and just not only to like find certain keywords, just to read and understand what is expected on the application, how it works, and especially when the application is like really complex and many features, sometimes it's just good to read docs and get a better idea of what you're looking at and
Absolutely.
understand what you're doing in the end.
Nice. Well, we got to wrap this episode here shortly, but you have two cool bugs here that I can't skip over. You've got arbitrary ATO via GraphQL and
Right, forgot
SSTI to
about that.
RCE via Ansible expressions. So where do you want to go, man?
Yes.
This is I'm going to sit back and get my water bottle and listen.
Yeah, so let's go with the arbitrary
Heck
ATO.
yeah.
So let's say the app is similar to Slack, where in Slack, I'm not sure if you know, but you can add like external users to your Slack
Right.
workspace, and they only have access to a specific channel. It's not the same thing, but the other thing was similar, where if I, as an admin, or let's say you as an admin add me as an external user to your own tenant, I will get access only to data that you give me access
sure.
to. Turns out though that the GraphQL endpoint on that application did not have proper authorization checks. So me, external user, I could make GraphQL queries. I did not have access to the data, but I did have access to the endpoint itself. I could run queries, but no data was returned. So I was able to
was
generate...
Was it just kicking back like null or something like that? Or
no, just like data, like, you know, the data object was just
empty. Oh, okay.
Interesting. But for some mutations, it did not work, but queries, it did.
This is pretty common. I've seen this many times, so...
I think something
I need to understand here. Continue. You've piqued my interest.
So I, as the attacker, aka external user to the application, I can do GraphQL queries. And then one query itself where there was like an ID related variable, I put like a single quote and it generated a nice verbose error message in the response. And in the error message in response, it did have an internal JWT, which the scope was assigned to sysadmin.
You'd love to see it.
And it also leaked two headers. One was related to the customer ID. For example, it was my tenant's ID, which is just like a public ID to my own tenant since I'm authenticated. But without authentication, you can't get those IDs. Mm. In a way. And also the current user ID, which was the admin of the application.
Dude.
Which was like the, let's say you. So it took me, so I reported that bug as is because I felt like the token is leaked as a sysadmin or superadmin. I'll let you guys like investigate it, don't want to abuse it, so reported it, ended up self-closing because the impact wasn't shown. So I was like, okay, I'll think about it and read the docs, read the API docs. I forget about it. 3 months go by. I was like, oh shit, let me look at this again. Tested it again, it works. But like, okay, I need showing back. So registered the docs, found a way to, found the API call that I need to do to make that token work, or not like make token, but like see where the token was used. Found the endpoint, confirmed that it did work. I could take over that admin accounts. That admin account. And I could also switch the header that was leaked with another ID, another user ID, so I could take any account over from my own tenant. But remember that tenant ID that I had said earlier? Those IDs are MongoDB IDs.
Ooh, enumerable.
So they're not, yeah. So it's possible to change the tenant, change the tenant ID, remove the user ID in the header so that you have access to only like the tenant data. And there is one endpoint in particular where it listed the user and the user IDs.
You love it.
So in the end, I could take over as an external user from tenant A, I could take over any user accounts from tenant B, C, D, E.
Oh my gosh, dude.
So
that's clutch.
It's pretty big.
Clarifying question there. Where was the JWT leak? Did you say it was in a header?
In the response, the error message in the response.
So was that like, you know, but like, was it just saying, hey, there's an error. By the way, here's the token. You know, like.
It leaked like the whole HTTP request. So it had like.
So some sort of reverse proxy was going on there. Yeah. Very interesting.
So it leaked the headers, cookies, there were none. CSERF token as well, but it was like set to nothing, source to nothing, as well as so the headers did have the JWT authorization barrier and then the value, then that specific header with the tenant ID and the other custom header with the user ID. So by all of that together, as an external user, I could take over any account on any other tenant.
Dang, dude. You love to see it. Whenever you get a nice verbose error, that helps so much. You can really infer so many things about the application by, using those a lot of the time. And even if it doesn't contain a bunch of information, doing error-based testing as well. I've seen Franz do that at a live hacking event not too long ago, and just essentially using his input in such a way that it would generate an error about something that he couldn't see, you know, and use that to infer what kind of, you know, data type this is, right, or what kind of object this is. Really, really fun stuff there. All right, last one, SSTI to RCE Ansible expressions, yes. Dude. I'm excited. Hit me.
So, do you remember, you just spoke about him, in his talk, yeah, on emails and RSS like that. Ever since his talk, I've always been putting SSTI payloads in my email. For example, JROC plus 7x7, blah, 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 curly brackets, blah, blah, blah. And it rarely works. It worked once, but it turned out it was like out of scope. But in this case, it did work. So I put in my payload, like in my email, as my registered user, worked on the app a couple of days. And it was like an app where people could spin up their own WordPress instances, and they would also get access to like their own PHP My Admin console where they could manage like the database, nice, and whatnot. And after a few days, I spent time just looking in the tables in PHP My Admin, looked at the user table and noticed that my email was JROC plus 49. I was like, oh shit, my SSTI payload worked.
Interesting.
But how and where? A few days later, literally spent probably 8 to 12 hours on figuring out what engine was used. I think I might have even asked the developer from the program on a previous report, like, what could this be? And they told me, I'm not sure if I figured it myself or they told me, they probably told me that it was Ansible. Mm. So since you could spin up like your own instances, it did use Ansible to like configure all of that.
Interesting.
And in the end, my input was being, the sync was in an Ansible config file. In a playbook, to be more specific.
No way.
So I could leak Ansible variables. For example, like, I remember just like as my original POC, I leaked like the Ansible config file. I could leak like the current user, so like that.
Wow.
And then later on, I was like, I can leak stuff. What if I can actually do stuff? So looking at the Ansible docs, I found the Ansible lookup command. So if you do like lookup, and then like in parentheses, pipe, comma, followed by the command, it'll actually execute the command.
Oh.
Yeah. There were a few restrictions on the characters though. So I could not put, all characters. I just had to hex encode them actually. So I actually downloaded Ansible, created my own playbook and tested to see how it worked. And it turns out that URL encoded characters did not work. I mean, it worked locally, but not on the application. Oof. But by hex encoding the characters that were blocked on the application, it still worked on Ansible locally. So yeah, it just led to a lots of reading and researching to finally an RC, which was pretty cool.
Dude, that's awesome. So this is what, you know, you have it as called SSTI here. And surely it is, but also it's kind of like configuration file injection as well.
Right. Right.
I'm wondering if, yeah, because configuration file injection is something we've kind of talked about a couple times on the pod, specifically surrounding some live hacking events that we were working on. It's such an interesting vulnerability type, and there's so it really does make you dive deep in reading the docs to actually figure out how to fully exploit it, because then you've got to become a master of this, you know, this arbitrary tool that you've never used, and you've got to figure out, you know, hey, can I use hex encoding inside of this config file and like that sort of thing. So it's definitely expands your mind a bit as a hacker to do those sort of vulns.
Yeah, I think I called it SSTI because when I originally reported it, I could only leak data. I could not get an RC. Yeah. And I was like, this is probably just like some kind of engine where it was weird. I think before even I found out that it was Ansible. So to me, it was like, it's evaluating my 7x7. It must be some kind of server-side templating engine that is evaluating that.
Yeah.
And in the end, it's like you said, it's not really an SSTI. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't say it's an SSTI. It's like you said, it's more like config injection leading to
Ansible is not what I, you know, you're going through like, is it Jinja? No. Is it Twig?
Well, Ansible is Ansible expressions, you know? I mean, Ansible, the expressions are based on Jinja.
Oh, are they? Okay.
So originally when I found out, I tried the typical payloads and that did not work. But I found out that lookup, lookup is actually a plugin, but it's installed by default.
Mm.
So with the lookup plugin, you can just do pipe and, I mean, the little string pipe in parentheses and then execute your own command.
Wow. That's awesome. That's a good takeaway too. You know, if you're really, really stumped on an SSTI or something that looks like an SSTI, think maybe, hey, there could be some surrounding functionality that's using a templating engine that you're actually injecting into. That's a possibility that I've never considered before.
The same thing happened with Terraform.
Oh, really?
Actually, I had a case where I could leak Terraform variables, but nothing more. I'm not sure if Terraform, I didn't dive too much in it since it was on the pen test, so I didn't want to spend too much time on it. But it has happened in the past where I could inject, I guess, strings or whatnot in a Terraform config file.
Dude, cool, man.
So there is potential with like everything infrastructure as code related and, you know, soft tools like that. So.
Whenever there's these applications that do things like spin up other services and stuff like that, even the most advanced stuff I find is duct taped together. You know, like somebody's shelling out, someone is like dynamically generating a config file and then, you know, having it loaded into this service. So those are the places where it really pays to dive deep and really understand, hey, especially if you have code, you know, it really helps if you have code, you know, to understand where those sort of delimiters, where those, the line between one environment starts and one context starts and ends. There's so many vulns to be found in that area.
That's true.
Dude, awesome bugs. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing all of these. This is probably, you know, you've shared a ton of vuln stories and lots of cool tips and tricks in there. So thanks for being so open with that and sharing your hacking success.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. I was happy to talk with you this morning.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, man. Have a good one.
And thanks, take care.
That is the pod.
Bye.